We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name is Ty Hildebrandt. Joining me, as always, over there in Chicago, Illinois, the one and only Dan Rubenstein, sir. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I was not on the previous show, was I? No, I was on the previous show, the show before that. So it's good to get a rhythm with you once again. I was not on the NIL show.
Correct. Correct.
You interviewed Michael Felder and Ross Dellinger, Felder from Stadium and IMG, Learfield Audio, and Ross Dellinger from SI. So I'm glad to be back in a rhythm. I'm glad to be back with you. I'm glad to be back with our guest who we're having on for the first time in a while.
Oh, man, Bill Connolly. Longtime friend of the show, Bill Connolly, formerly of SB Nation, now with ESPN. Bill is the grand poobah of all things advanced metrics as it relates to college football. The SP Plus is something that we cite regularly here on the show that we've taken great stock in over the last couple of years as we've tried to put together our own projections and predictions and just to be more informed about the sport on the whole. The SP Plus and what Bill does is all just very rich content. So we had him on last year. I think if memory serves, either in the throes of the pandemic or during the pandemic, just to try and make heads or tails of what all the numbers meant. And right. I think we're trying to continue some of that conversation today. Just looking forward now into 2021, how much of what we saw last year is relevant? How much of it are we crumpling up and throwing into the wastebasket?
Well, I mean, there were elements to me, Ty, that rang true no matter how many games, no matter the kind of year or season it was. I mean, Notre Dame losing on the stage they lost on felt like a piece of normalcy in troubled times. So, no, I kid. I'm a snarky idiot. It's a very good question, and it's very difficult to make heads or tails of it. So, I'm extremely thankful that we got Bill C to come on the show and sort of talk about everything from a numbers perspective, everything from a non-numbers perspective. I want to ask him about his campaign to be college football commissioner from a few years ago and how that's coming along. And just in general, you know, how his numbers have evolved in evaluating and projecting out the sport we love.
For sure. So Bill Connolly will be stopping on by here momentarily as we slowly ramp up and get a little bit closer to the college football season. Dan, don't forget, we've got all sorts of excitement coming towards the end of next week. We hope you will be with us.
Oh, yeah.
Hope you'll be with us on
all of our shows. We're 9 days out from an off-topic show available to Patreon Verballers only. Verballers.com for more information. 12 years in the making.
Yes, that's been the branding. You came up with that on the fly, and it's good.
12 years in the making, a show that I think I've wanted to do for a long time, and there have been obstacles, and we now get to do the show.
We now get to do the show. We will talk about that. Verballers.com. Yes. Again, the off-topic show will be available only to our Patreon subscribers, but
correct.
A lot of excitement coming next week, so we hope you'll
yes, sir.
Tune in for that. Dan, how about without further ado, we kick it over to our friend Bill. All right, Dan, joining us once again, longtime friend of the podcast. You know him well, works for ESPN these days. His name is Mr. Bill Connolly. Sir, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys doing? It's been a while.
I
don't know. I don't know what time is anymore. Like, I think it's been a
it's a flat circle, and you're also wearing your Solid Verbal t-shirt, which I don't, did you coordinate that in advance, or did we just pick you on the day?
This was the creepiest thing. You kind of revealed that you do have cameras established in our house somewhere, because Dan sent me an invite like 2 hours ago. I was already wearing it. I was already ready.
I love it. And the answer is yes, we do.
Just don't tell me where. Like, I don't want to know. Just, it's fine.
We have information on most notable college football media personalities.
Correct.
And we're using it for data mining and advertising purposes. So
that's of course.
All good.
That's where
no
the
problem.
Money is.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
where it's at.
Yeah. So, yeah, everybody should be reading Bill Connolly. I mean, he's previewing teams. He's doing tennis things.
Yeah.
He's doing soccer things. He's at ESPN, ESPN Plus, and doing his previews. Right now, you're on the Big 12, I believe.
Yeah. Knocked out the first half of the Big 12 this week, second half next week.
Did you learn anything? Was there anything surprising to you when you dug into the Big 12 specifically?
This is very specific, but the one thing that I had to fact check twice because it just didn't make sense to me. Texas Tech hasn't had a winning record in 5 years. I mean, they've been to 2 bowls, finished 6-7 or whatever. So, I mean, sort of. But yeah, it's kind of dire there, or at least not Kansas dire, but it just hasn't, like, there's been no momentum whatsoever there for quite a while in Lubbock.
Kansas dire could be a term that we
I mean,
use a little
be
bit
really
more
selective. You got to be really selective when you use it, because that is dire.
Yeah.
Are there other teams that you've been previewing, not that are necessarily dire, where you're just like, I did not realize that, either in a positive or negative way, where you're like, that rushing attack these last 3 years has been stupendous.
Yeah.
Anybody like that?
Well, on the negative side, Stanford was, that threw me off a little too. There was 60th in SP Plus last year, won some close games, so their record was okay, but just like the fundamentals, especially on defense, were just dreadful. And whereas such a large portion of the country returns, like everybody this year, they lose their starting quarterback and Fajoco, and most of their defense comes back.
Paulson Adebo,
that's really a good thing. And so, it is. That was kind of a weird, like, the projections on them, they were projected 68th, and it just kind of threw me off, because they did have a decent record. But that one took a little getting used to, and we'll see. They've got pieces, obviously, but we'll see if they can pick
up
more of them.
That could be a metric, Ty. Maybe you're really good at branding. What is it about? So we have a lot of returning production this year because of the eligibility stretching. Obviously, 2020 was, you could choose to have it affect your eligibility or not. And you've just written a number of pieces about returning production and the importance or lack thereof. I wonder if there is some kind of branding for, yes, they return a lot, but returning bad production. I don't know if there's a way to brand that.
Right. That's all, that's something that every time I post like updated returning production figures, like I did Tuesday night, it kind of has the same conversational cycle, because you look at that and you see the top teams and you're like, oh, they're going to be good this year. Like, no, they're going to be better. That's there's a difference if you were the whole garbage in, garbage out or whatever. Like, having a bunch of returning production means you're probably going to improve. That doesn't mean that I'm looking at the list here. That doesn't mean Rutgers is ready to be like a top 20 team just because they returned 92% of their production. It wasn't very good production. It was better, but it wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. East Carolina at 15th. A lot of these teams were pretty good. Akron being 25th. probably doesn't mean a lot for Akron this year.
Right.
So
right.
That is something that always you see your name up top or at the bottom where like Alabama, Ohio State, those types of teams are like, they're probably still going to be pretty good, but it's all about, you know, this is a really good barometer for whether you're moving up or down.
Well, and another point too, and it kind of leads into our line of questioning here. Context for 2020 is so important. I think the last time we spoke with you, one of the things that we wanted to know, and it might have been mid-season if memory serves, we wanted to know at the time, how are you like viewing all the statistical information? And your answer at that time was, I'll get back to you.
Bye.
I really have no idea. Do we know anything now that can help maybe inform how you view 2021? Or is it still sort of like,
Well, I think... the first thing I did, I tried to crank out as much of the returning information as possible in January. Right at the beginning of February, we put out the initial returning production figures, initial SP plus projections, all that stuff. And so at that point, I was kind of flying along. Like one of the things to keep in mind, I guess, is that, you know, SP plus, there's a, you know, a sliding scale, so to speak. Like after, if you played three games, then your rating is based on X percent of the preseason projections. And then it slowly gets phased out as the season goes. So in a lot of these cases, teams only played three or four games and their final SP plus had a whole bunch of those preseason projections in there. And so that's very much not optimal. But the more I think about it, I mean, it's just, it is what it is. Like the point of those projections are basically program health, how are you recruiting? How have you performed over the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years? And then, you know, how much of last year's team do you return? The more of the summer that goes by, I'm more comfortable with just kind of leaning on those long-term figures and saying, here, I mean, we probably know how these teams are going to be based on that. And one of the things I've done since those initial projections is I've just kind of set up a sliding scale too for if you're Ohio and you played three games last year, your returning production, like, I mean, they return a lot of their production. That's great, but it's only going to have like, it's not going to have as big an effect as like Alabama playing 13 games.
Right.
So it's going to lean even more on those long-term recruiting, well, mostly long-term performance numbers, just because that seems to make the most sense to me. It's just that they're pretty stable overall, and that's what I'm going to go with. That's going to hurt the Pac-12 if you saw those initial projections where like everybody in the Pac-12 was returning back in February, and therefore they were all like projected to jump up into the top 25. They're still going to be projected, you know, to improve, but more like top 30 or 35, not necessarily like seven teams in the top 25 or whatever it was. So. That's where I'm at peace with the situation now. We're just going to lean on those long-term factors. They're probably going to be pretty good no matter what. And then we'll just, we'll see how that goes.
Have you gotten any feedback? I mean, I already know the answer to this. Yes, you've gotten feedback.
Yes.
But, you know, anytime you post any new metric, have you gotten any interesting qualifiers? Because I would expect that you would probably have seen your fair share of them after 2020.
My favorite so far is anytime I mention anything about projections or whatever, there will be at least one LSU fan that I know that I've interacted with many times say, well, I just don't think 2020 should count for anything. And there's a very clear strain and
so
relevant
return
strain.
Bo Pelini should be back.
Sure, exactly. No, like there's a clear line of logic to it. And I understand it. At the same time, they had a whole bunch of plays, a whole bunch of drives, a whole bunch of games. It looked bad for a good portion of them. And that still means something. It doesn't mean now that 2020 is over and we're going to pretend we never hired Pelini and we got another coordinator in, it's going to be 2019 all over again. Everything's fine. It still means something that they struggled as much as they did last year. But at the same time, Stingley was snake bitten all year, and the defense had just comical communication breakdowns that you rarely see from a major defense. That's probably not going to happen again. The offense, of course, was playing three different quarterbacks and all those things. It's clear that those, you know, it was not as relevant a sample as you would normally get, but I'm sticking by the logic that it still means something. And if like LSU is going to be kind of borderline top 25 in the projections, I'm fine with that. Like they could obviously be much more. If they go 12-0, we're going to be like, oh yeah, of course they did. Look how talented they are. But on average, they're still probably not going to do that.
Was there anything confirmed because of the extreme circumstances of 2020 in that, like, okay, here is something that confirmed a suspicion of mine about home field advantage or playing on the road or weeks off or weird injury luck and guys sitting out. Was there anything, because of the extreme nature of everything, was there anything that actually helped confirm things?
No.
Okay.
No, what's funny is midway through the season, the answer would have absolutely been yes, because, you know, home field, the first, I don't remember what it was now, 4 or 6 weeks of the season, I kind of just started off playing with a 1 point home field advantage instead of the normal like 2.5. But when I was starting to play with the numbers a month or so into the season, it seemed like it should probably be more like about a 0.5 point as opposed to 2.5, which was really interesting. And then the rest of the year, the value started going up from there. Like, I don't know if that was a trend or if it was just regression or whatever it was. So I became less certain about that than I was before. And then early on, like SP Plus killed the first half of the season. It got killed the second half of the season. But even with all the postponements and, you know, Virginia Tech missing 17 players for that one game or whatever, projections were kind of good. And so I was thinking, you know, that's a good sign for those, like these big program health types of things that I talk about. Like, this is still very reliable, whether it's this person playing or that or whatever. And I felt pretty good about that. Then SP Plus got its butt kicked the second half of the year when, you know, when a whole bunch more players and teams just kind of checked out. So,
right.
Yeah, like I thought I had some read on conclusions. And then the second half of the season, I had none whatsoever.
So how different overall was SP Plus last year than previous years with regular sample sizes?
Not
I don't
bad.
Know if it's, I mean, against the spread or just compared, like, I don't know what metric you use as success for SP Plus.
Yeah, I mean, the two I generally tend to lean on are, well, I mean, against the spread, because that's what everybody wants to see out of it. So that's definitely when you kind of have to track. And then the other one is just this absolute error figure, which is basically like whichever direction you miss, how many points are you missing by? So in a good year, it'll be 53-54% against the spread and like a 12.5 something in that neighborhood point average error, basically. Last year it was like 51% and like 13.1 something in that neighborhood, 13.2 maybe. So it was definitely off. Even early in the year when it was doing well against the spread, it still wasn't hitting 12.5 in terms of that average error. But I mean, it was still over 50%. It was still like,
right. It wasn't significantly swung in a direction.
Right. It was still better than flipping a coin. It was just that, among other things, Vegas had a better read because you know, when you're setting those lines, you are much more, you're accounting for injuries, accounting for absences and all that stuff. And SP Plus isn't designed to do that.
Over the long term, and this is something you've chronicled, your five factors, right? The factors that help to that most determine who wins a game. Obviously, and I believe this is still the case, explosiveness, how well you generate big plays and how well you prevent big plays is the biggest telltale sign of who is going to win a game of your five factors. Have any of those five factors, so that's also what? Efficiency, field position, the turnover battle. I'm missing one of them right now.
Finishing drives.
Have any of those swung in a bigger sample size? Like in the last 5 years, have any of them gone up, down 2, 3, 4, 5%, anything like that?
Not really. I mean, I think the most interesting thing, the most interesting conclusion that I've reached about anything in like the last 5 years is just how reliable the efficiency angle is compared to explosiveness, for instance. Like, you count up the big plays and the turnovers, you know who probably won the football game, but you can't then coach that and say, well, hey, go
right,
make big plays. Don't turn the ball over. Go take that ball away. You know, that's not coachable, really. Mm-hmm. But the efficiency angle, that success rate measure I've always talked about, you know, 50% on first down, 70% on second, 100% on third and fourth, that is easily the most stable and reliable. And so that, through the years, that has come to take on more weight within SP Plus as a whole. And, you know, that feeds into how well you finish drives. If you're able to carve out smaller chunks of yards, that's a decent sign that you're able to finish drives well. It's a field position thing, because even if you punt, if you've gotten two first downs first, they're going to be pinned inside the 20. So it feeds into all those other factors for the most part. It feeds into explosiveness, really, because you got to be on the field to get the big plays. Mm-hmm. You got to stay on the field to get the big plays. So that really has kind of crystallized in my mind. Like that is the most important thing. And it's great because coaches have been preaching it for years. And in this case, they've been right to do so.
Have there been any metrics that are getting close to cracking that top five?
Yeah.
Like, is like the percent, what a metric that I love that you do right now, and you tweet about this and write about this, is the percentage of drives that go three and out.
Right.
Right. There's something about that that rings true to me. I don't know if it is statistically significant like the other five, but that's something when you watch a game and you see your team consistently go three and out, you're like, there's no way we're winning this game.
Right. No, I mean, that's the other side of the field position thing. If you're going three and out, you're losing the field position battle.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, basically that feeds into efficiency. My favorite, my havoc rate, mm-hmm. tackles for loss and passes defensed and forced fumbles per play, basically. That also informs that success rate measure for obvious reasons. I mean, you're pushing people backwards. Not only are you, preventing a successful play on that play, you're also creating like a third and 15 that they're probably not going to convert. And that's another point in your favor from a success rate standpoint. So things like that are very useful and they kind of feed into it, but really they feed into success rate, and success rate is still kind of the dominant measure there.
Bill, do you have any way in the SP Plus to quantify new coaches or changes in a coaching
or
staff?
Or track record of coaches in some specific things, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I can say that overall, I already have that spreadsheet pulled up. Let's see, let's put that going. Here we go. Because I was playing with this earlier. So on average, a coach's first year, on average, you're going to drop about 0.8 adjusted points per game. That's how I present SP Plus, is adjusted points per game. You're going to drop about 0.8 on average that first year. Now, if you're inheriting a terrible team, then you're more likely to improve than if you were inheriting a great one. So there's still context there, but I thought it was interesting enough. Year two, however, you improve on average by 2.7 points per game. Year three is 1.3, year four is 0.1, and then basically five onward is just kind of a slow trickle down effect, unless you're Nick Saban, apparently. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the average, like you're most likely to, and we've talked about this before, it's semi-common knowledge, at least, that like, yeah, your second year is your best leap opportunity. Your third year is your next best leap opportunity. And then after that, I mean, you've either already leaped or you've gotten fired pretty much. So it does, that second year leap opportunity is big. And that's kind of interesting heading into this year, because like if Washington gets a second year leap, they're like a top seven or eight program. But was last year a first year? Does it count as a first year last year? Is this like, so we'll see what kind of effect. I played with that because I wanted to see if I should add that to the projections themselves. I know FPI does that. ESPN Stats and Info Group does that with their number. And I've been fiddling with it, but I don't think I'm going to do it this year just because I don't know what any of that data actually means this year.
So when you're looking at a coach, maybe not a new coach, but someone who's been there a while, I'll use Jim Harbaugh as an example, mm-hmm. Or anybody, frankly, are you looking at that individual on like a 3-year, 4-year time horizon? Like if it's working by the end of the fourth year, we're good. If it's not, or if it starts to trickle, you see that number go in the opposite direction sooner. Are you able to use that with any kind of reliability to predict who's going to be canned versus who's going to stick around?
I wouldn't say not directly. Like I don't include that in the, it's Jim Harbaugh's sixth year or whatever it is now. Therefore they're not likely to jump any higher than they currently are. Like that doesn't make it into the numbers. Certainly makes it into the opinions. However, I mean, we certainly know his best chance for a leap, and he did engineer a leap those first 2 years. But he didn't get quite as far as everyone hoped. And now we've seen that kind of slow trickle down. It is hard to rebound once you've kind of gone past that initial 3-5 year cycle. It's not impossible. And we don't have a big sample of guys who got the chance to rebound. Some of them did, Gary Pinkel, but, but like that is certainly a concern if you're a Michigan fan right now. Is like, it's, you can turn the ship around again. It's just, it's a lot harder to do the second time.
I bring up coaches in the first place because on the last episode Dan and I did, he basically backed me into a corner into being Steve Sarkisian's biggest fan.
Yeah.
I'm in the front car of the bandwagon.
In the front car of the bandwagon. Okay, this is why we invited him on, Dan.
Yes, of course.
So what we did on the last episode is we looked at some of the early lines, for whatever that's worth. And I think we saw in week two, maybe Texas is
Arkansas,
Texas is only a 3.5 point favorite against Arkansas. There's a game later in the year against TCU where they're a 1.5-point dog. There are a couple, there are like three or four Texas games that we called out, and it felt to me like the lines were disrespecting Texas in like a true Michigan State fashion. It just didn't seem right to me that they would just not be given more respect. What did you see when you did the breakdown of the Big 12 and looking at Texas? Why are you in the front car of that bandwagon?
Yeah, it's really annoying when you're like, you know who's underrated this year? Texas. There's nothing more frustrating than that. It's you feel so gross. I mean, the big thing with Sarkisian is he never, like, the rap he got at Washington was, you know, they never really broke through. They never got they never won a division title. They never whatever. Yeah, he inherited a program that ranked 114th in SP Plus. And even if you'd use like a 5-year average, because I mean, there are obviously special circumstances, just weirdness. It all, you know, snowballed that last year. They still were at like a top 75 average before he arrived at Washington. Then they went 67th, 60th, 53rd, 49th, and 15th the last year. Lost a couple close games, only went 9-4 that last year. And Washington fans were just fed up with him. Like, this is just, we're done. He's a mediocre coach. We need somebody to. And granted, they still made an upgrade when he left for USC. They then turned around and got one of the five best coaches in sports. So they made an upgrade. But those are the guys I end up finding myself defending a lot. Is, you know, the yesterday I had a Big 12 fan or a Minnesota fan yelling at me because in my Big 12 preview, I said Glenn Mason was underrated at Kansas. He was so mediocre. Like, yeah, here's what Kansas and Minnesota were before he was there. Here's where they were when he was there. And then here's where they were when they left. Like, it was still, he achieved more, as did Sarkisian, than he was given credit for. So that's, I've never really considered him an elite head coach, but I found myself defending him a whole lot over these last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And then he goes to Alabama eventually. We know, you know, everything that happened at USC and all those things. But he goes to Alabama and crafts the most, I don't want to talk specifically about talent, but, you know, last year they had the most perfectly modernized offense and optimized offense that we've ever seen, even more than LSU the year before. Yes, talent had to play with that, but just the way they created matchups, the way they used motion, the way they used RPOs, all those things, like, he knows what a perfect offense looks like. That doesn't mean that Texas is going to rank first in every offensive metric this year, but I'm confident at this point. I'm as confident in his offensive knowledge as anybody in the sport. And he's got Bijan Robinson and maybe a good quarterback and fast receivers and all that. So I think there's definitely reason for them to at least play at like a top 20 level. I mean, obviously, you know, we're thinking of this, you know, if it's Texas, then top 20 isn't really, you know, amazing. But at the very least, their offense should be awesome. And their defense, we'll see. I love the Kwiatkowski hire. But, you know, they definitely have experience. They've always had experience and recruiting rankings in their favor. And that hasn't resulted in good defense in a while. But, yeah, everything you're saying, like right now I'm looking at, you know, from those February projections that I talked about, I had them favored by only 5 against Louisiana because Louisiana just blew up the returning production measure out of the water. But then I have them favored by 6 against Arkansas, 19 against Tech, 3 against TCU. What did you say those lines were?
Texas TCU was a dog by 1.5 against TCU?
TCU was a 1.5 favorite at home against Texas.
TCU could be awesome too, but they have more offensive question marks than Texas has defensive question marks, I think. So, I see them as certainly a top 20 team, and it's really to count the ifs, as that piece that I write each June, it doesn't take that many ifs to make them a top 5 or 10 team.
I'm glad we got to Sark and Alabama's 2020, which, and I looked this up and you include this in your metrics, but their points per drive without garbage time was something like 4.4 points per drive, which is cartoonish. It's an absolute cartoon. It's the biggest number, I think, ever. If we were probably to look back, it seems like it is more than any of those Oregon or more of those Oklahoma Lincoln Riley teams.
Yep.
I know. When you look at like NBA advanced metrics, we know pace, we know, you know, offensive rating, defensive rating, and we can adjust per the era, right? Yeah. Like, we know that, you know, in the last 10 years, whatever is the case with the NBA of how many possessions per game. Do you adjust for era? Can you look at like what Alabama's 2021 relative to the last 5 years, median points per drive, whatever, how much of an outlier that is for the era compared to, say, I don't know, Nebraska's 1995 offense relative to the era? Is that something that you've ever examined?
I mean, sort of, because like I still, you know, we still only have complete play-by-play going back to, you know, 05-ish, basically.
Right, that's true.
And so it's hard to dive too far into some of these just because we, I mean, from before that, we'll probably have yards per game and yards per play and points per game and all that. Mm-hmm. But we won't have necessarily the dramatic selection of detail that we now have. I can say, as I play with the filter on this little spreadsheet that I have pulled up, that in the last, what do you want to say, 50 years? We'll say 50 years. So since mm-hmm. 1970, 2020 Alabama ranked 10th in offensive SP Plus as a percentile of everybody's offensive rating. So not just that raw, I mean, their adjusted points per game last year is 50.8. That's pretty ridiculous. But when you adjust for the eras and the other teams in the country that year,
right,
they graded out of the 99.7 percentile. 99.9 percentile on offense.
Right.
The 1983 Nebraska offense is the best on record in that time with 99.994 percentile. So it was right there. It was right there with the best offenses we've seen. The other ones from the 21st century, the only ones above it are 2018 Oklahoma, which was pretty great.
Yeah, right.
And strangely enough, 2004 Louisville. That's a fun one to throw into the mix there.
And we always assume, obviously, with every sport, athletes get better. Coaches get better
right.
over time. So
right.
it's not crazy to say, oh, yeah, the 2020 Alabama offense in dealing with the smartest coaches and players have ever been in terms of technology and scouting is the best offense probably yeah. we've seen.
It was actually this. It's funny to think about the stats that Mac Jones produced last year and the fact that he didn't win the Heisman. Like I think the Alabama's perfection hurt him.
Yeah.
Because he didn't end up, he still right. at the end of the year didn't really get all the credit. He was like, well, I mean, they just look at that talent. Like, well, yeah, a lot of teams have had talent and loads of talent, but nobody else had done that before. And he was the second quarterback on the Heisman voting, and he was the second Alabama player on the Heisman voting. And that's still kind of mind blowing to me.
I want to go back to factors a little bit. Is there anything that you wish you had data on that you think would make your numbers smarter? That's just, you know, is it injuries? Whatever it is, mm-hmm. is that what I see you nod and say, what do you wish you had?
Yeah, I mean, the injury thing is, I think it's harder now. It's worse now than it was like 5 years ago to keep up with who's out, who's hurt and all that. That, you know, because I mean, now I got the worldwide leaders dashboard at my disposal.
Look at this
guy.
Pressure numbers. I got snap numbers. I got all these things now that I wish I had for like the last 20 years so I could kind of compare and understand what I'm seeing a little better. But we still just don't really have, especially after last year, you know, being able to isolate, you know, how many games the you know, this player or that player was out and what effect it had. Because, I mean, that really does. I mean, it would be great to have like an injury adjusted SP plus. They're 6.8 favorites, 6.8 point favorites, but the quarterback's hurt, therefore they're only 3.7 point favorites or whatever.
Right.
But just compiling that is really hard. One of the gambling sites, DonBest.com, had a good running list for a couple of years there. But
I remember.
I don't think it was even all that up to date last year, or not nearly as reliable. And because finding the information is hard.
Yeah.
And coaches are getting more paranoid and making that information less available. And so that's frustrating. I think it would be great to have a reliable injury list, so to speak, and we're never going to a college at the college level.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
When you look at year-to-year improvement, is there a metric that you find teams outperform their expectations per SP Plus and underperform expectations? Because like, okay, their talent wasn't all that different, their schedule was pretty typical, but their havoc rate shot up, or their passing explosion rate shot up. Is there an outperform underperform number that you tend to see?
Well, to flip that around the other way, there are definitely the numbers that you know, if they were too good or too bad last year, whether SP Plus accounts for them or not, or only does indirectly, it's you know, you've got plenty of those factors. The old Phil Steele turnovers equal turnaround thing.
Right.
And, you know, I've got my second order win totals and everything where, you know, looking at the post-game win expectancy number that I come up with. But like, it's really been interesting because, I mean, every year somebody goes like 6-1 in one score games and therefore drastically achieves its record. And you can, Bud Elliott and I at SB Nation for a long time tried to kind of isolate like what are the factors that go into that. Certain coaches are more likely to win close games. Urban Meyer was always good at it. Bill Snyder, Ken Niumatalolo, they always overachieve by like one win per year compared to what SB Plus thought they should have had. But what is it about those? Is it the ones that really can just always convert third and threes? They have a good kicker, you know, they can,
right.
They're always in field goal range. They can, you know, just some of those factors. That was one of the things Bud always talked about is like quarterbacks and good special teams. You know, those two things, it seems like can make at least a one win difference per year. So that's always, there are always those teams that catch fire and some of them do it too much and it's unsustainable, but you do figure there's something in there regarding just the little details, the, you know, the middle eight that Clemson always does well at and all those little things that you can just produce a few more points per game. And that's something that I don't think SP Plus probably accounts for enough. Like it gets down that road, but it probably doesn't account for quite enough yet.
Let's stick with coaches. Because you are so deep, both with your previews and looking at the numbers all year long and watching the games that you watch, it all goes into your sort of brain stew. Are there any coordinators that, and I'm just talking purely from production, and a lot more goes into either hiring a coordinator as a head coach or taking a coordinator at a smaller place and making him a coordinator at a bigger place. Are there coordinators that whose name you repeatedly see or whose schools you repeatedly see and you think to yourself, somebody get this guy. Somebody throw money at this human.
One of them is Kwiatkowski at Washington, now Texas. He was one that I've been interested in for a while. Obviously, Jimmy Lake kind of hopped his name in the pecking order for Peterson replacement, but he's been associated with a lot of really, really good defenses. Andy Avalos is one.
Yeah.
And he went back to like the perfect spot for him, obviously, going back to Boise State. Yeah, his defense wasn't even all that amazing last year, but
no.
I'm very, very confident that he's going to do well at Boise State. He knows everything he needs to know there. Let's see. I had to pull up a list of teams because I was guaranteed to get somebody, but I do think, well,
Like, I remember seeing like Todd Orlando's name at Utah State, mm-hmm. and he would put together the best rushing defenses year in and year out with his defense. And I remember Tom Herman hired him without ever having met him, just because his reputation preceded him. And he actually put together some good defenses at Texas and, you know, had bad injury luck. There are all sorts of things that went into it. But there are always those names. You're like, somebody's going to hire this guy.
And I think with a lot of those guys, like, it's basically like Don Brown. Like, if you give Don Brown two good cornerbacks and two good defensive ends, doesn't really matter what else he has. He's going to have a killer defense. And so maybe it's the same way with Orlando. He obviously improved USC quite a bit there. He had great safeties and at least one good cornerback at USC last year, whereas year before Texas, their defensive backfield was a giant mess, both in terms of injuries and development. So, you know, maybe it is kind of like that. You just, each guy needs a couple of pieces, a couple of items for, and then he can make a good stew out of it. So, along those lines, like, give Phil Longo a couple deep threats. He's going to use them. Like, that doesn't mean he would be a great offensive coordinator. Like, I almost don't want to name a school because it would sound mean now, but like it, you know, if you go to a school where you've got a 360-pound lineman and three good running backs, but the receivers are all kind of slot possession guys, maybe he doesn't really know what to do with that recipe. Give him two deep threats and a quarterback who can throw a long way, and he probably is going to score 35 points a game. So that's kind of been interesting. It was funny at the end of last year with everything being so weird. Like, when guys did get fired and the coaching changes were still made, I didn't really have a list in my head of, okay, this guy better get a job this year. And maybe that's why we saw kind of a weird set of hires, like the Beamers of the world, who didn't really have the killer coordinator experience. But it was, I mean, everything else was so weird about 2020, so that's not a surprise. But yeah, we got to the end of the road, just didn't have a list of, this guy has to get a head coaching job this year kind of names.
Hey, Bill, I've got in front of me an old article of yours going back to 2017. So a little over 4 years ago, which, you know, we were all younger and more full of life back then.
More naive.
Sure. This is back in your SB Nation days. This was your Bill Connolly for College Football Commissioner piece.
Ah, yes.
And it's interesting on a number of levels because you had nine pillars, nine things that you were including as part of your vision for college football. By my count, five of them have actually been fixed. Now, fixed is a relative term, mind you.
Addressed. They've been addressed.
Thank you. Thank you. Addressed. They've expanded the playoff now. You had advocated at the time for 6 to 8 teams. There's a lot going on now, as you know, with NIL, which could bring back the video game, which is one of the things that you called out, as well as modifying what amateurism means. There's a tie in there with like a student athlete bill of rights. Recruiting has been tweaked along the way here. Where is the Bill C for CFB commissioner at right now? How are you feeling? Like, this campaign's been dormant, let's say, for a while. But if you had to dust off the old vision statement, how are you feeling about the state of college football with some of the advances we've made?
I feel like I'm a pretty good commissioner, honestly.
Yeah, so. You're nailing it.
No, I mean, yeah, like, obviously some of them were addressed in ways that I didn't necessarily intend. Like, we zoomed right past 8 to 12, which still, I don't dislike a 12 team playoff, but I still just kind of like, wow, that wasn't necessary. Like, 8 was good, but but now like, we're in a world where 2016 Colorado goes to the playoff, and I just like, I'm still wrapping my head around that a little bit. But but no, like, the modernizing amateurism thing, obviously that work's not done by any means, but we finally, 4 years later, like 10 years after we all started talking about it, that hurdle has been cleared to some regard. And the next year is going to be so much fun because everybody's just going to be throwing stuff at the wall. Half of it's not going to work. That gym in Miami that's going to apparently start paying like $600,000 a year to Miami athletes. We'll see if that keeps up. But, like, that's going to be, the marketplace is going to be fascinating, and then it'll kind of write itself, and I'm sure it will start to benefit Alabama within a couple of years. But But still, like that has been at least addressed, and we are finally going down that road, and we can kind of put a tentative X over that one. That one's been nice. The Student Athlete Bill of Rights thing was intended to kind of go down that same road, and it was intended to not only cover name, image, likeness, but just like long-term health care and some of those things that ended up in, it was a Chris Murphy's Senate bill that probably won't pass because there's a lot of other stuff in there that people will reject. But that one, like just the healthcare aspect of things, especially if, you know, even though the students get to make money now, and that's awesome. Like just if we're really going to set a system up to where teams are playing 17 games, up to 17 games, like the healthcare aspect of things still needs to very much be specifically addressed. And in this case, whether it's just like, you know, insurance, whether it's a medical trust fund, whatever it is. So that one is, I think, the ball's rolling, but there's nothing specific about that. The video game, that one, it was funny. Like all these serious things I had in there in the video game was the one that without a doubt was like, yes, we have to. Yeah. But not only name, image, and likeness, but the group licensing, the progress that's been made in that regard, seems like we're headed within a couple of years to getting the video game back.
It's such a weird turn of events as it relates to the video game. Because we've had this conversation, this show, I'm sure you've had it, you know, countless times on your own, Bill. It is incredible to me that we're going to look back at that last version of the NCAA video game. And when we tell the story of college football 50 years from now, that video game is going to have such an outsized impact on the way things went as it relates to amateurism and just like so many different aspects of college football. We could never have predicted that back then, but this is where we're at now.
Didn't really see that coming when I was playing NCAA 98 in the dorms.
Right, we're on year 98 of our dynasty, right? Like you could never have foreseen that it would have that kind of lasting impact.
Yeah, no, that it has been, and that game in particular, like not even, you know, we still have Madden. Technically, you can still play football on any video game platform, but that game in particular, in the dynasty mode specifically, was just even more of a game changer than we realized at the time when we were, you know, staying up all night and playing into 2024 or whatever is in the dorms. But yeah, like that one, like what else? Games are too damn long. That was another one of the pillars.
So I was going to bring that up. So the ones that I'm looking at that have been addressed in some regard, bringing back the video game, expanding the playoff, the student athlete bill of rights and amateurism, those kind of have morphed together to some extent, and recruiting, right? Recruiting is kind of always in a state of being addressed. The four on here that I wanted to talk through with you very quickly, you have a couple things related to scheduling. So fixed scheduling by scrapping divisions and moving to like a pods setup, which we can
ball's rolling on that,
which we can discuss, of course.
Yeah.
We have non-conference scheduling, and you've labeled this get weird. This is introducing the concept of having like a bracket buster Saturday of sorts to maybe be a little bit more contextual as it relates to a season. Promotion and relegation, which I love, but it's never going to happen. That will never happen. No. It's a ballsy effort.
But you know what? I love the idea somehow. And this is like a branch coming out from the trunk of promotion and relegation. I love the idea in the way that, and maybe we'll do an episode in the next couple of weeks about this, that there are really intriguing elements of other sports, right? Like at the top of F1 racing, which I've really gotten into, they have like a mid-tier, I forget what the name of it is, but like there's like a legitimate battle for like number four, right? Yeah. Like everybody's like, well, look, we're not in the top three, but like we can be the best of the rest and be legitimately respected for it. There has to be some sort of weird element as the top of the sport sort of pulls away recruiting wise, championship wise, that we can say, okay, but here's this other thing that we can take pride in. I don't know what it is.
The very broad stroke idea behind promotion and relegation is make this damn sport like actually merit-based. Like, you know, because that was, you know, as the example I always give, like most of these conferences are, their membership is dictated primarily by who your friends were in 1932. And therefore, Kansas football always gets to be a power conference team, and Boise State will never be a power conference team because they didn't have the right friends in 1932. Boise State was a community college, I guess, at that point. But that plus geography means they're screwed. No matter how many things you do right in a row, you will never have the membership that the power conference membership that like Wake Forest does. And that stinks. I mean, yeah. Sorry to Deke fans, but
and Wake Forest, like, is totally fine. They are. They're not Kansas, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
Right, they're not Kansas.
Not Kansas Dire, right?
Right,
right. Kansas Dire. But yeah, like, no matter how many wrong things Kansas does in a row, they're in the Big 12 no matter what. And you know, it just kind of, most, you know, like, obviously the promotion and relegation idea came from European soccer, and European soccer has its own haves versus have nots problem. It's not like it solves everything, but you know, it was just the idea that this sport is just has never been nearly merit-based enough, and we should figure out ways to do that. One of the things I'm curious about is, yeah, we're not going to have promotion and relegation, but the one when I don't remember what years this was now. Again, time is not my friend. But when the Big 12, the last time the Big 12 was thinking about expanding, you know, and they were stringing Houston along and then decided to not to do that after all. But one of the things that came about from that was, like, what if the Big 12 expanded to 24 teams and was just two Big 12s? Like, you know, just incorporate the AAC and have just like a one conference promotion relegation thing based on, like, the, you know, you have two 12 team conferences, the two worst go down, the top two from the bottom come up. Like, within a structure, you could kind of do that, especially if we're going to be in an era now where there's no such thing as a Power Five, where the six top conference champions get in. Like, have fun with that. Like, you know, you want to create a conference network where you always have inventory and always have something going on. Then have a 24 team conference.
That's such a good idea.
So, like, even if we can't connect the SEC and the Sun Belt to where Vanderbilt gets relegated and App State goes up or whatever, we can still do that. Like, that would be...
Well, then suddenly the Big 12 becomes the coolest conference
exactly.
In that it's the unique quality of, one, you're going to get a hell of a TV deal. Two, you get to talk about the Big 12 in a different way than you get to talk about any other conference. And three, even if you're not a Big 12 fan, you're probably more likely to have an eye on that conference more than perhaps another conference that you're not affiliated with.
Yeah, and you got basically that top tier, that 12 team conference, whoever's in it in a given year is going to be the best conference in the country, or second best at worst. And, like, nobody's going to be outside the top four
we'll
in the
depth.
Conference
yeah.
because all the dead weight's gone down, and the Houstons and the Cincinnati's of the world are now in the Big 12, and you just got a glut of awesome teams. And
it also, like, solves a sort of playoff entry issue, right? That, like, you're not getting into the playoff, and obviously now it's changed with whenever the 12 teamer starts.
Yeah.
But if Cincinnati keeps just wrecking shop, it also keeps coaches at places, right? It's continuity. If Luke Fickell keeps winning 10-11 games at Cincinnati, and Cincinnati is now considered to be a whatever Power Five champion, what reason does he have if he has the infrastructure and the ability to get into the playoff every year and get buys or whatever? Why would he go to Michigan State, which he turned down? Why would he go to Virginia or Texas Tech, something like that?
Right. Tom Herman doesn't have to leave Houston. He can just go and continue to try to build the state of Houston, you know, seal the borders there and do really the things he was doing some really fun things there. There's nothing saying he would have kept it up even if they were in the Big 12. But yeah, those stories don't have to end as quickly. And that would just be more fun.
The other thing that you had here was that the games are too damn long, which, you know, we agree on that. But let's go go back to the pods thing. So you had talked about one way to help with scheduling is to scrap the divisional setup, and you would propose pods. So for people who aren't familiar, Dan and I are, but for people out there who aren't, what do you mean by pods? How is the ball rolling? What did you mean by that?
Yeah, what's funny is technically pods, it's not the right term to use, but it's just what we use. And so, you know, whatever. But it originally stems from the WAC, the mid-90s WAC, where they expanded to 16 teams. They had four pods, and you basically play your pod and somebody else's pod and round robin every year. That was the idea behind it, and it was pretty cool because at the end of the day, most teams, there are a few, like, there are Tennessees out there that contradict this, but for the most part, most teams don't have to play more than about three teams each year. Like, they, like, just absolutely have to, you know, we absolutely have to play our rivals kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And so if you were to take, like, the SEC and give everybody three permanent rivals, again, like, that's hard for Tennessee. It's hard for LSU. They've kind of got more than three, but for everybody else, it kind of makes sense. So that's three games a year. That leaves you 10 other opponents each year. Play 5 1 year, 5 the next. Within 4 years, you've played everybody in your conference in a round robin. Like, the only reason Missouri and LSU have played twice in the first decade that Missouri has been in the Big 12 was because the schedules got weird last year and they added LSU at the last second. That's the only reason. I think they played, like, last year was the first time, the second time they played Mississippi State. I think they've only played Ole Miss once, I believe. It's just hard to feel like a conference.
Yeah, I think A&M Georgia played for the first time in 2019 became conference partners. Right. Yeah.
And all you have to do is take away an annual Missouri-Florida game or Missouri-Georgia or whatever, and all of a sudden everybody's rotating and it feels like a conference and you have a history. Because that was one of the things, like the 4 years I was at Missouri in undergrad, Missouri played all of its Big 12 rivals twice at least. You know, they played six of them twice, but the other five, four times, every, you know, once a year. And it felt like you had a history with Baylor and Texas Tech and A&M and all those other schools, because you were still, even if you weren't playing them every year, you were still playing them frequently. And it, like, that's all you have to do. Like, if you have it works perfectly. The math works perfectly with a 14-team conference that plays eight games, like the SEC or ACC. It gets a little messier if you make it nine games and the rotations are a little weirder and all that, but it can obviously be done. And you're connected to everybody. And as a Missouri fan, this wouldn't help Missouri at all, because now suddenly you're playing Alabama and LSU and Arkansas, or not Arkansas, Auburn more. But it would still just, it would make you a part of the conference you're in, and it would feel like an actual union there. So that's just from that standpoint, I like it. But also now it does feel like the ball's rolling. Like, the actual conference higher ups of like the ACC have talked about it a little bit. And it seems like, you know, if we're entering a 12-team era, a 12-team playoff era, you kind of want, you don't want a random ACC Coastal champion beating Clemson, knocking them out of like a top four seed, maybe not getting one of the playoff bids anyway if they had only gone like 7-5, right. And just kind of generally screwing your conference by pulling an upset to talk about forever. You don't really want that anymore. If you're the head of a conference, you'd rather have a situation where you got your permanent rivals, big rotation, top two teams make the playoff or the conference title champion, game, yeah. Boom, you're done. So it's not necessarily what I had intended with my thought, but it is another reason for them to go down that road. And it seems like maybe there's progress in that regard.
Is there any element to normalizing non-conference portion of the schedule? Obviously, the NFL has their way where they have these cross-divisional matchups that they do like essentially home and homes with over a couple of years. I know you're a proponent of eight conference games across the board, and it works well with pods because eventually everybody plays each other over the course of years, or a couple of years, 2-3 years. But the non-conference portion of the schedule, obviously it's good for the sports health for FCS programs to get into the mix. And it's not the worst thing for teams to have a week to, you know, sort of get the motion into the season, whatever. But what is your dream scenario for the non-conference portion of the schedule? Number of games, how the games are scheduled, how the game is, you know, are there ping pong balls where just the Pac-12 draws the AAC and they're like, well, is Oregon going to play Cincinnati? Are they going to play USF? Like, is there an element that appeals to you from the non-conference standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, and we've already passed this by, but like the coolest thing about 2020's football season, one of the few cool things about 2020's football season, was BYU and Coastal going, hey, you want to play on Saturday? It's, it's Wednesday afternoon. You want to do this? Oh, all right, sure. We'll get on a bus. And they did it. And it was like the number three game of the year at the end of the year. And there was energy. There was just, it was a fun matchup that we haven't seen. Like, there were just so many awesome things about it. And obviously, when you're selling season tickets, you want to be able to tell your home crowd who they're playing. So you can't go too far down this road. But everybody loved it. And I was hoping we could figure out a way to just introduce a little fewer, hey, Alabama and Boston College are going to play in 2034 types of situations. And as soon as the season ended, we went right back to that. And it's kind of frustrating, but yeah, I mean,
Ty, you're going to turn 53 during that season, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that math update.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Doug Flutie's going to be like 75. So that was, you know, in that commissioner platform thing, the thing I talked about was the bracket buster idea, where basically, you know, go ahead and schedule games, but you got to leave one date open each year. And right. about 3 weeks out or 2 weeks, or even 1 week now, we know you can pull up a game in a week. You know whether you're playing at home or away, but based on any number of different ways to separate teams out, you basically, depending on how your season is going, you are drawing an opponent that is having a similar level of season. So if you're a right. Cincinnati, and or UCF in 2017, where you've got an awesome team that has nobody to play, depending on your ranking, suddenly now you got a home game against Georgia and you get to prove yourself completely.
Yeah. Oh my God, ping pong balls, please. It would be an incredible ratings bonanza. It would be the NBA draft lottery.
You got to get your boy George Clavicle on the case out there, the Pac-12 dude.
Oh my God. If we just had that random show on, God, I don't know when it would be, October 1st or Halloween or something like that, for like the third to last week of the season, it would be a bonanza entertaining show.
Oh my God. Like, that would be all the best parts of Twitter too. Like, reacting yes. to that. It would be the draft lottery, like times 30 or something.
And you have the cameras in the bars like, no.
that would be great. And I just wish there was, like, we've seen what flexibility can do. Flexibility was forced on everybody last year, and granted, everybody handled it poorly in August, but then in November we started to kind of adapt and figured things out, and I wish that would be part of it. Apparently it's not going to be.
No. Final question, and we'll bring it back to the 2021 season. We are now in July, which means we now not only have previews, we have takes, we have sports radio, we have TV, we have conversations around the 2021 season. Are there conversations around teams in either direction where you're like, I'm sorry, you think what about this team? Or what is nobody going to mention this team in this conversation? Do you have those teams that are not like sleepers or overrated, any language like that, where you're just like, I don't know. I don't think the conversation might be a little bit misguided around in either direction, these teams.
LSU is one. Just in that, like, I mean, some people are taking the plunge and deciding, you know what, they're back, and right. others aren't. So I can't really say that's like a conventional wisdom kind of thing. But that one's been kind of interesting. I mean, it's kind of hard to a degree because everybody kind of agrees. Like, we know five of the top six or so. So
right.
Any of these conversations, it's going to be like, oh, really? You think they're number 12? And that doesn't quite carry the same kind of like weight necessarily. But I will say, based on last year's sample, we're probably not taking Wisconsin and Penn State seriously enough. They both had super weird situations last year. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin playing a small schedule, looking great, then taking a bunch of weeks off and having a hugely rotating depth chart and all those things, worse than a lot of other schools. Like, on paper, my numbers love Wisconsin because they're so reliable most of the time. But then also they return a lot of the guys who should have played more of a role last year but didn't. Mm-hmm. They seem to have a definite top 10 potential. I'm not real sure we're thinking about that. Penn State, I mean, they got the offensive coordinator they probably wanted last year in Mike Yurcich, who scores 40 points a game wherever he goes, or 37. And they've got at least two really good receivers, a veteran quarterback. We're not real sure what Clifford's ceiling is, but he's probably got like top 20 QBR ceiling at the very least, and lots of good running backs, and their defense is always top 20. So that seems like a pretty good recipe. Another one that we kind of have a handbrake for at all times is Miami. Along with the same kind of Texas yeah. vibe, I guess. Like, oh, here we go again. We're picking Miami to do great things. They got a lot to offer this year, like more than they have. And the only thing they lose from last year is basically the two defensive ends, but they always have great defensive ends. So if they have right. two more this year, then they don't really have a hole. And they've definitely got top 10 potential, which they had last year until they completely ran out of gas the last two games. So those are some teams that were probably just not, I'm not going to pretend any of them are like top three potential or anything, but those are three teams that probably are going to be better than our general assumptions think.
Fair enough.
All righty. Bill Connolly from ESPN. Enjoy the rest of the Euros. You have to come back and talk soccer with me.
Oh God, please, just give me that chance.
Okay, how about this? Who is your number one tennis player under 30? If we want to talk passion
God,
sports.
So the next gen. The newest next gen.
Are you at Tsitsipas? I mean, team can't stay on the court. Like, who is
right.
it?
Yeah, Tsitsipas is the most well-rounded. Obviously, he had a really weird month and bowed out at Wimbledon against a guy who had already played like 15 grass court matches. But yeah. Tsitsipas is going to be awesome. He's the closest thing to Federer of the next gen. Just wonderfully well-rounded. And I did get to write about my boy Seb Korda this week.
Yep. Ty, ask a soccer question. You can do that too.
Oh, no, I have too many soccer questions. So we're going to bring Bill. We'll bring Bill back on.
You want a U.S. men's team, women's team opinion? Do you want a Euros opinion? Ty, you got to give him something.
It's coming home.
You think it's going home? England? You think it's going
to
England?
No, I don't. I think it's going to Italy. But it's more fun to say it's coming home.
I have won a ton of money on the Euros. I told this to Dan.
Really?
Yeah. We have to talk. We'll bring you back
on. Do you
have
a system?
We need to talk about exclusively international soccer. Exclusively international soccer.
We actually, in our Discord, people are talking about it. So it would actually make for a good off-topic show. I don't know. Whenever it is that you want to do that, Ty, I don't even have to be on the show because I don't know it.
Exclusively international soccer as it relates to the build-up to the 2022 World Cup. I have many thoughts, Bill. Many thoughts.
I will keep tamp down my RB Leipzig opinions. That'll be a different conversation. I can focus on international.
We can talk about that too, but we will bring you back. You and I have to talk soccer at some
deep
point.
Deep Bundesliga thoughts with Bill Connolly.
Bill Connolly.
Give me that chance.
How much money is Borussia Dortmund going to make? Okay. Moving on to the end of the show, but first we need to thank you again, Bill Connolly,
yes,
for your insight. As always, we do appreciate it. And yeah, we got to talk soon.
Absolutely.
All right. Again, Bill Connolly, ESPN, ESPN.com. Every time Bill is on, I feel like it's just a brain dump. I feel like we get so much information out of him. I never want to end the interview. We have time constraints, mind you, but never want to end that interview with him because he's just such a great source of college football information.
Was I correct in assuming that RB Leipzig is Bundesliga?
It is Bundesliga. And I believe They now have an American coach going into the 2021 campaign.
What do you know what RB is?
Red Bull.
Oh, is it?
I believe so.
Oh, that would make sense.
I don't know that for sure. But if I had to take a guess, I believe it's Red Bull.
Rasenball Sport Leipzig.
Right. Red Bull.
Informally Red Bull's Leipzig. Right. All right. Yeah. I mean, I can't ever understand, and it's probably because I'm a bit of a dum-dum, how people can really truly go deep in more than one sport. And you see a lot of people do a very poor job of it in like the big, broad, generalist sports media. But people that like legitimately are very good at covering multiple sports and sort of having informed opinions, I don't understand it at all. I'm so impressed with it.
Yeah, Bill, his statistical view of the sports world is awesome. So it extends to things like soccer. It extends to things like tennis, which I know is that's a sweet spot for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we always welcome him back to the show. And hopefully we'll have to have him on at some point real soon.
We're coming up with something recurring for him.
Yeah,
hopefully we'll get him into trouble. But yeah, there will be something recurring with Bill C. He aligns too perfectly with us.
All right. Well, again, don't forget to stay tuned in over the course of the next week and far beyond that, because we've got a lot of excitement as we build towards the college football season and get into previews and whatnot. So please do stay tuned on that front.
And we're ramping up to 3, right? And not too long here.
That is correct.
Episodes per week.
That is correct.
And within the next couple weeks.
If I can peel back the curtain just a little
please,
bit.
Please, those onions. The kimono.
If you can peel back the kimono, that may be one of the things we discuss next week.
Interesting. Okay.
Stay tuned on that front. But otherwise, please do head on out to all of our social media accounts. We do have a Twitter, a Facebook, an Instagram. We also have a newsletter, which maybe we'll start ramping up at some point in the very near future. If you go on out to solidverbal.com and look for the big yellow box, you can enter your email address. You can also go to newsletter.solidverbal.com and sign up there. But a lot of exciting stuff coming down the pike, Dan. That's all I got, man.
I
got.
I have not eaten today. It's 2:04 Central Time. So I need to find calories.
For that guy over there, my good friend Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildenbrand, we will talk to you all in a few short days. In the meantime, stay solid.
Peace.